That's Hank Mobley on tenor sax for the title track from his 1963 album on the Blue Note label, No Room for Squares. Lee Morgan on trumpet, Andrew Hill on piano, John Ory on bass, and Philly Joe Jones on drums. Hank Mobley was born in Eastman, Georgia. He was a hard bop soul jazz composer and band leader. Largely self-taught, he was performing with some of the great names in jazz by the time he was in his early 20s. He died in Philadelphia of pneumonia in May of 1986 at a mere 55 years of age. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we'll be talking about two things that seem unconnected, but they actually are very much so connected. The Nevada Democratic Convention ended in chaos on Saturday after 16 hours of backroom dealing by party hacks to produce a desired result. What was that desired result? Hillary Clinton will have Nevada. It's all hers. In one of the most flagrant examples that I have seen so far in this election cycle, a flagrant example of vote fixing, of a real scuzz bucket politics, state bosses scuttled the party's own rules and ran roughshod over any semblance of fairness in the Clinton-Sanders battle for delegates. Because, you know, I said early on in the game, I told you this was where the fight was going to be. This was where Hillary Clinton was going to work her advantage as a party hack herself, and making sure that the party establishment falls in line to deliver victory for her. And so far, they've been doing her bidding quite well. But the obscene display of a disregard for any semblance, I mean, even the slightest notion that things are being run fairly, That just went out the window on Saturday when Bernie Sanders supporters were calling for a recount because, you know, at the state convention, this is where the party bosses kind of gather together. They make their own convention rules. They have any number of ways of just going over or under or through established rules. They make up their own rules because they already had the outcome in mind and they were commanded to produce the result. And the result was to pronounce that Hillary Clinton had the lion's share of pledged delegates. So they began this count and there was a motion that came before the assembled body because there are many people there who had some questions about that. Hillary Clinton was said to have 1,695 delegates, and Sanders was said to have 1,662. However, the Sanders supporters said that there was something wrong with that number because there were 64 delegates who were supposed to be Sanders delegates who were just unilaterally disqualified from participating in the vote. And so Sanders supporters at the convention demanded a recount. Well, you would think, well, this is the Democratic Party. This is the state party, the Nevada Democratic Party assembling at its caucus here. And you would think under the gaze of television lights and cameras rolling and in the presence of thousands of witnesses, they would kind of, you know, behave themselves and at least pretend that they're trying to conduct a, quote, democratic process here. But instead, this is what happened.
The motion is this. I am asking you to have a recount. 9:30 was too soon for a preliminary vote. The petitions did not get to everyone. Everyone wanted to come in and get a seat or get their badge or get things at the different tables around and get their pins. But they didn't get the petitions. And that's what we need. You can't count petitions if nobody got to sign them.
Hell broke loose. And I'll explain why, because you could hardly make out. There was a lot of noise because there was a lot of anger in the room. And it was about the clear intention of the party bosses to absolutely go against every single semblance of order. Robert's Rules of Order, forget that. That went out the window. The voice you heard was that of Roberta Lang, who is the Nevada State Democratic Chair. And we had heard from at the beginning of the tape, you hear a voice, this is a voice from the floor saying, look, we didn't even have our credentials in and we didn't have the people who were supposed to be voting were not prepared to vote because some of their names did not even appear on the lists and so forth. And we should have a recount of this vote. So she was asking for a recount on the basis that, according to their calculations, this is the Sanders supporters, the Sanders delegates, the number of delegates for Sanders, which was registered at 1662, should have been more, certainly more than 1662, because 64 delegate votes were unaccounted for. So the request from the floor was for a recount. And quickly, Ms. Lang, the Nevada State Democratic Chair, decided that she was going to put a motion on the floor, and the motion was to pretty much accept the count as it was. And then she seconded her own motion, and then she says, she rules, after seconding her own motion, she rules, she says, and I quote, "The ruling by the chair is not debatable. We cannot be challenged," she says. "And I move and I announce that the rules have passed by the body." This is total unilateral decision-making going on in the face of clear concern and clear doubt that the count was accurate, and in defiance of the rules of convention, where people have a right to question something that they seem to be concerned about because the math just wasn't adding up. But we have this now compounded by the convention chair, the state Democratic chair, deciding on her own that she was not even going to wait for the nay votes. She asked all those in favor, and you had a bunch of people screaming yay, and the nay votes never did get heard, even though, of course, you heard how loudly they were protesting that they wanted this recount. And she said, the ruling by the chair is not debatable. We cannot be challenged. Well, all right. And the place erupts into total chaos. Even as we speak, there are all kinds of legal moves being made to challenge the outcome of Saturday's Nevada State Democratic Convention. And the consequential ruling, if you will, or the determination that Hillary Clinton carried the state in terms of delegates. And we know the saga of the delegates. That's where the bodies are buried. Okay, now, what does this mean? It means that we're seeing something that is so perfectly in line with the way the Clintons historically have done their politics. Sleazy, patently unfair, but it apparently passes muster with the Democratic Party and its leadership, even at the highest level, and I'm referring to the president. Not a word has been said about this debacle in Nevada, that the Democratic Party behaved like the parties it condemns in other countries were being so corrupt and so off base, so disgustingly unfair. But that's what you heard. It's documented. This was a scuttling. This was theft. This was voter fraud, if you will. Because in the end, the delegates are the stand-ins for the popular vote. The people who are voting, the delegates are apportioned according to the popular vote. And if as many as 64 delegates went unaccounted for, and there was such absolute resistance to even making sure that the process in fact was legitimate, you see how you can make a reasonable determination, you could come to a reasonable conclusion that the process was corrupt, wrong, undemocratic, illegal, fraudulent, and sanctioned by the Democratic Party. See, two things you have to conclude. It was wrong and fraudulent and scuzzy and just absolutely undemocratic, corrupt as hell, and it was okay by the Democratic Party and even by the so-called leading Democratic candidate. It was okay all the way up to the titular head of the Democratic Party, the president himself, who is busy these days preaching about morals and telling people what they should do in the interest of promoting justice and freedom and equality. So basically, this process, this horrible, rigged, fraudulent process, confirms something that had been going on for quite a while in this election cycle as it concerns the delegate process. How the parties, both the Republican and Democratic parties, have used this delegate system to essentially frustrate and in some cases outright nullify the popular will and the popular vote. The parties are both corrupt. Donald Trump, I'm no fan of Donald Trump, but he has a point. This business of the delegates and how they are apportioned and their role in the Democratic Party, which essentially is a role that mitigates or could even undo the popular vote, and people calling this part of the political process, part of the democratic process. And here we have the Democratic Party. I mean, that's the greatest pun of all time. The Democratic Party behaving this way in public, where things are documented, the cameras are rolling, the tapes are rolling, and they do this in the open, brazenly denying the process and negating the will of the people and nullifying the vote and doing so with impunity. Now, we have to ask some questions here, and I've raised these before. Simply to say that this is party business does not mean and should not mean that the party is above the law. When these elections are being held, the general public is inclined to believe or is made to believe that this is part of the process, the voting process, and it isn't. The party is doing its business, and it has been given great latitude to suspend, it seems to me, to suspend the law as it applies to voting and voting rights, and to arrogate unto itself the power and authority to do things it wishes to do. Now, in the real world, it seems to be, the integrity of the vote outside of strict party process should hold up within the party convention process. But we don't see that. It's as if these political parties, the duopoly particularly, the Republican and Democratic parties alike, understand that they don't have to obey the law. Nothing could happen to them. Nobody could be indicted. Nobody could be in charge with voter fraud. Nobody could be charged with anything, because this is party rules. And party rules, we are to understand, supersede constitutional law. The party can make up whatever rules it wishes. This woman just said, and you heard it, the ruling by the chair is not debatable. We cannot be challenged, she says. Well, I mean, that's party rules, as they made it up. And then she says, I move and announce that the rules have passed by the body. Unilateral decisions that supposedly will never, ever hold up outside of this crazy, chaotic, corrupt process. And yet, we are told this is the democratic process. This is about voting. And therefore, the assumption is voting rights apply. The people's voting rights are to be protected, whether it is within the party structure or outside of it. We haven't heard a peep about this scandalous convention and the outcome. And yet, it perhaps is the most blatant example, but these questions have arisen before. These concerns have arisen before in the course of the 2016 presidential campaign. So how is it that these parties get away with this? And how is it that we do not have media people just all over the place on this? Because the intention is, again, this is part of the intended outcome, the intention is that Hillary Clinton can do no wrong, and they're protecting her. Because they've decided, the powers that be, that the matchup, the eventual matchup that will really make things hum this election year, is the contest between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And that is what I was talking about last week when we discussed political inevitabilities. That's one of the inevitabilities. So however she emerges as the nominee for the Democratic Party, even by a process so corrupt, so patently undemocratic and unfair and illegal to my mind, it doesn't matter. As long as it produces the inevitable, which is that Hillary Clinton will be the nominee for the Democratic Party, and on the other hand, Donald Trump will emerge as the nominee for the Republican Party, and things will be great. Both characters are absolutely, I mean, they're hated, although they're very popular. They're not liked at all. There are major questions about their character and their integrity and all of that, but that's not important. I told you from the very beginning that the thing to watch here in this election year is the role of media and the amount of money that is going to be available in this election cycle to media for campaign advertising. In excess of $5.5 billion will be spent. And the media, of course, things are not going too well for them in the regular world of advertising. They're looking for this kind of infusion of advertising dollars to keep going. They're having a rough time. Advertising is dropping off and going digital. They have no use for mainstream media anymore. It's going into highly segmented areas. That's where the money's going. But if they could keep this horrid cycle going, if they can make the inevitable happen, they stand to make some money, a lot of money, because the campaign dollars are soon to flow. And they're playing the game, and the party is playing its part. The leadership of the party is playing. Everybody's choreographing their moves according to the ultimate interest, which is money-driven. Money. It should bother us that we saw this happen in the open. It should bother us even more that there's dead silence about it. This is not whether you're a Bernie fan or not a Bernie fan, but it should bother us that this kind of, we've reached this point, this low. We've sunk this low. And therefore, I come back to my question that I ask all the time, what are you going to do? The Democratic Party, absolutely, in my view, must be destroyed. It serves no useful purpose. It has to be destroyed. And the best way to do it is to part ways with it. Give it absolutely no support. None whatsoever. If it could do this, as it did on Saturday, there's no reason to hold on to a party that has such disregard for not just the process, but for the integrity of the vote. And the party leadership, and we're talking now on Monday, has yet to come forward and say, this is not us. This is not who we are. Quite the opposite. They're celebrating the fact that they had a convention and that Hillary Clinton emerged victorious. What a crock. But what a reminder to us that we've got to do something. We have to reject that. We have to reject a party that behaves this way. And we must destroy it. Because it now has it's infectious. It contaminates. And it shows absolutely no remorse at all about the intentionality of its crookedness. It's just clear. They're behaving. It's like a marauding team. There's nobody on either side of the fence here that you can look to and say, well, you know, they're the voice of reason. There's no voice of reason here. It's a mad, maniacal scramble for power at any cost. They don't care. And they suspect that we have sunken to that level as well. We have sunk to that level that we will tolerate it and put up with it and say nothing about it and do nothing about it. And that brings me to the other half of my program today, which actually is an article by Dr. James Petras. And Dr. James Petras, let me just remind you of who he is. He's an extraordinary scholar. He is a Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University and author of more than 62 books and 600 scholarly papers on imperialism and global oppression. And here in this article, and it was refreshing to find it, he notes that progressives, and I use that in quotation marks, have a sordid history that we need to keep in mind. That sordid history I've talked about, and it was incredible to me to find reinforcement for the discussion I've had here on this program about progressive people who pop up on the scenes and as candidates offering something different, offering themselves as alternatives to the system, when in fact, in some cases, it turns out that they are in fact political acolytes of the system, and their job, their main job, is actually to thwart progress. This is an article that was printed some time ago, and it's just extraordinary. He titles it "Democratic Party Primaries: Progressives as Political Contraceptives." I mean, Dr. Petras, he does not pull any punches at all. This was, in fact, in Counterpunch, the article ran, but it was from December of last year. And it is so apropos to the climate that we are, the political climate today. So I'll read it to you. It's exactly what we've been talking about here on this program. Over the past few decades, insurgent mass movements reflecting political discontent with the domestic economy and imperialist foreign policy have emerged to challenge the leadership and policies of the Democratic Party. There are good reasons for this. The Democratic Party in power in Congress and the White House presided over, one, the deepening of inequality between labor and capital, two, the decline of real wages, three, the approval of repressive legislation, four, the reduction of trade union membership by two-thirds, five, deepening inequality between the races, six, $1 trillion and counting bailout of the banks and Wall Street. Seven, mortgage foreclosure against millions of homeowners. Eight, endless police state abuses by federal and local police. Nine, deregulation of the financial system. And 10, the offshoring of manufacturing jobs and service employment. Over the same period, the Democratic Party has supported wars and invasions against Indochina, Panama, Grenada, Yugoslavia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Somalia, and scores of clandestine military operations, including the recent and current proxy wars in Georgia and Ukraine. Popular movements have emerged, and mass public opinion has expressed hostility toward both major parties. Hence, the third parties struck a responsive note among the electorate, to which the Democratic Party leadership felt threatened by a possible defection by wage and salaried voters, especially to supporting Ralph Nader. Yet in the end, nothing came of the discontent. Despite large-scale and deeply felt anger and popular outbursts of protests, including the million-strong street demonstrations against the invasion of Iraq in 2002-2003, the Democratic Party continued to dominate the progressive electorate, or regulated it to demoralized abstention. This essay addresses the following questions. 1. Why have mass movements and genuinely disaffected progressive voters and activists been unable to break with the Democratic Party, despite its consistently abominable record on foreign and domestic policy? 2. How was the pro-Wall Street, pro-imperialist Democratic Party able to retain the support of an electorate which overwhelmingly polls in favor of health care reform via a national single-payer health plan, a living minimum wage, the end to police state surveillance, and against serial wars and invasions? American mass movements have been successful in mobilizing hundreds of thousands in opposition to Washington's support of the South African apartheid regime, Central American dictators, wars in the Middle East, and racist legislation. Progressives have educated and organized millions to oppose Wall Street and the Democratic Party's more recent bailout of banks. Without fail, every time mass movements and the popular electorate have opted for independent social action outside of the Democratic Party, a dissident politician has emerged from within the party, mouthing many of the criticisms and demands of the social movements and the critical electorate. These democratic dissidents organize grassroots campaigns in popular venues, soliciting small-scale contributions, and making promises to put an end to big money and big business domination of the electoral process. Such Democrat dissidents round up millions of votes and hundreds of delegates to the Democratic Convention, and then they inevitably lose to the party machine and meekly submit, reasserting their loyalty to the greater good against the greater evil. The radical rhetoric used during the campaign is consciously designed to obscure the dissidents' fundamental loyalty to the Democratic Party, its military machine, its billionaire fundraisers, and its Wall Street economic policy strategists. The preordained primary campaign defeat of the Democrat dissidents is not the real issue here. The essential political consequence is that the dissidents channel mass social disaffection back into the Democratic Party, thereby undermining any independent political initiative capable of breaking the duopoly stranglehold. In animal husbandry, they are like the handsome goat who tricks the flock into entering the big slaughter pen for their social and political aspirations. By endorsing the crowned party nominee, these dissidents discredit the very critical ideas and social programs they claimed to promote. They demoralize and depoliticize important segments of the electorate. They demobilize and disorient the social activists who had worked for the social transformation promised by their campaign program. Most important, by reorienting the peace and justice movements and the neighborhood and anti-racism community organizations into Democratic Party electoral politics, they empty the streets, neighborhoods, and workplaces of effective activists. A brief survey of presidential campaigns over the past 35 years confirms this analysis. Jesse Jackson was an important leader activist in the civil rights movement. Based in Chicago, he helped organize tens of thousands of Afro-Americans and develop ties with other minorities, white progressives, and trade unions. Jackson opposed President Reagan's assault on the trade unions, especially the firing of thousands of air controllers. Jackson's opposition to apartheid South Africa and Reagan's invasion of Grenada and the escalation of military spending gained him credibility in the peace movement. Millions looked to Jesse Jackson for political leadership and a new political direction. He negotiated with the bosses of the Democratic Party for his entry into the primaries. The deal was that he would compete with the traditional politicians, but immediately submit to the leadership if he lost the nomination. Jackson mobilized hundreds of thousands of activists from the northern ghettos to the Ivy League college campuses and from the textile factories of North Carolina to the cotton fields of Mississippi. He rolled out the rhetoric about social justice, raising the minimum wage, a single-payer Medicare for All national health plan, and a massive transfer of public funds from the Pentagon to domestic social programs. He secured an impressive 18% of the vote in the 1984 Democratic primaries. Upon defeat, he immediately capitulated and endorsed the Wall Street cold warrior Walter Mondale. He campaigned for Mondale with a promise that the Rainbow Coalition would influence the campaign in subsequent Mondale presidency. Nothing of the sort happened. Mondale lost. Reagan was reelected. The Rainbow Coalition was as ephemeral as its namesake. 4 years later, a recycled Jesse Jackson trotted out the same rhetoric, the grassroots organizing, the ghetto gab, the poverty hustle, and the pot of gold at the end of the Rainbow Coalition with white and black togetherness to the amusement of the party bosses and corporate funders. It was all hands on deck. The street movements shifted from concrete local struggles to door-to-door voter registration for the Democrats. Trade union locals were attracted to Jackson's Save American Jobs rhetoric. Middle-class progressives were attracted to Jackson's promise to cut the military budget. And Jackson received a substantial 29% of the Democratic primary vote. Michael Dukakis won the nomination, and, as promised, Jesse Jackson endorsed the party's choice and instructed all the civil rights, social justice, and peace activists and anti-Wall Streeters to work for his election. Dukakis was resoundingly defeated by George Bush Sr. in the 1988 election. At the end of the rainbow and over a demoralized and depoliticized peace movement, the Bush administration led the U.S. into the first Gulf War. The wreckage from the popular movements turned electoral machines offered little resistance. Confused by Jackson's double discourse, the disaffected masses fractured. 4 years later, the few pieces were picked up by Wall Street flunky Bill Clinton. Once in office, and after tooting his victorious saxophone, President Slick Willie proceeded to decimate welfare programs, roll back the Glass-Steagall laws, and deregulate the banks, launch a merciless 90-day war to break up Yugoslavia, and maintain 10 years of bombs and starvation sanctions against Iraq, causing the deaths of 500,000 children and many more adults. Just when disgust at the consequences of Clinton's rotten policies and peccadilloes and George Bush Jr.'s grotesque wars were beginning to unite the disaffected, Dennis Kucinich popped up from nowhere to launch a white working class version of the Jesse Jackson Rainbow Coalition in the Democratic primaries of 2004. Saving a lot of money on placards, he recycled the same slogans about a national health system, minimum wage boost, higher taxes for the rich, anti-Wall Street rhetoric, and public ownership of utilities from the Jacksonites. Since there was still a substantial, strong anti-war movement, he called for the impeachment of President George Bush Jr. for lying to the American people about Iraq. He criticized congressional Democrats for supporting the fabricated pretext to invade Iraq and called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the Middle East. His presidential primary campaign within the Democratic Party attracted a small army of disaffected voters and contributors who otherwise would have bolted from the party for the Greens and their candidate, Ralph Nader. In the Democratic Party convention, Dennis, looking more like Alfred E. Newman than any righteous working class leader, petered out with nary a mumble. He lost the nomination to the uber militarist and upper class hero John Kerry without even a flaw fight or speech. He endorsed the obnoxious crown prince of the Democratic bosses, Kerry, an ardent pro-war member of the billionaire class and defender of the U.S. Constitution shredding Patriot Act. Kucinich managed to corral the anti-war and anti-Wall Street Democrats into submission, seriously undermining the anti-Bush mass movements, especially the anti-war activists, and the rising tide of Americans who openly favored the single-payer national health program, an extension of Medicare for all. Kucinich ran again in 2008, but he was already damaged goods. His belly crawl performance at the 2004 Democratic Convention had alienated most of his backers. But even more important in relegating Dennis to the dustbin was the emergence of a new, slicker, and infinitely more persuasive con man, Barack Obama, the Hawaii-raised, Ivy League-polished, and Chicago-crowned chameleon of many colors, cadences, and cliches, who burst on the scene playing every instrument in the band. Barack Obama's con job far surpassed any previous effort by Jackson or Kucinich. His mind-boggling ascension on rhetorical bubbles left rival Hillary Clinton, long used to the cant of Slick Willie, literally pop-eyed and slack-jawed. During the 2008 primary, he embraced the progressive demands of the anti-war movement, promising to end the Iraq War, bring home the troops from Afghanistan, and close all the U.S. torture camps at Guantanamo Bay. He promised to finally develop a national health plan, hinting broadly at a Medicare for all model, and regulate Wall Street's unbridled swindles and speculation. Easily seeing through his fluffy rhetoric, the Democratic Party's Wall Street backers secured hundreds of millions from billionaires with which to finance a real grassroots movement in style, defeating an astonished Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primaries and swamping the mega-millionaire Republican candidate Mitt Romney in the general election. The zealot like Obama adopted the Baptist minister's deep and musical cadences in front of black audiences while savaging and disowning his militant black religious mentor from his Chicago community organizing days, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who had condemned the war in Iraq in frank biblical terms and alienated his Chicago Zionist financial backers and Israel-centric inner council. No longer useful, the good reverend was effectively thrown under the bus, an object lesson on introducing Ivy League graduates into mass community struggles and enabling their ambitions. In office, Obama allocated $1 trillion to bail out Wall Street while letting two American householders sink under mortgage debt and, letting 2 million American householders sink under mortgage debt and foreclosures. He expanded ongoing wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and went on to launch new wars in Libya, Syria, and Yemen. He supported the violent coups against popular elected governments, known as regime changes, in Honduras, Ukraine, and Egypt. The recycled and bamboozled anti-war leaders who backed his candidacy and lies were discredited, the remaining movement fractured. Initially, upward of 80% of U.S. public opinion expressed support for the anti-Wall Street Occupy movement, but they had no mass-based political organization to sustain the struggle after many of their leaders swam and ultimately sank, tied to the lies of Obama. Under Obama, more American blacks have been murdered by police with complete impunity. More abortion providers assassinated and clinics bombed than under any white Republican president. As for humanitarian intervention, in Libya, tens of thousands of ethnic sub-Saharan Africans, contract workers, and Libyan citizens died at the post-Gaddafi ethnic cleansing of Libya by the racist warlords unleashed by Obama's air assault. The bewitched progressives were befuddled by the Ivy League's black president and didn't notice that social inequalities had deepened at an alarming rate. As for access to health care, the American people were forced to buy private insurance plans, many of which were worthless. Meanwhile, deductibles and copays skyrocketed, forcing all but the well-salaried to forego necessary medical care. The notion that access to health insurance was equivalent to having effective health care has been one of the biggest shams of the Obama era. Life expectancy for large segments of the low-income rural and small-town Americans has dropped, an unimaginable development in previous eras. During Obama's presidency, the political climate turned rabid right-wing and the progressives turned tail and ran. Right-wing extremists swept the Republican Party and then seized control of the Congress and the Senate. After 7 years of failures, frustration, and futility under Obama, progressives found themselves without a movement and without prospects. Over 92% of U.S. private sector workers were unorganized and faced continued decline in their standard of living. Black, Chicano, and Asian neighborhoods were subject to large-scale brutal police raids and the extrajudicial killing of minority youth, the homeless, mentally ill, and the poor continued with impunity. Over 2 million immigrant workers were incarcerated and expelled. Tens of thousands of young immigrant and free mothers and their children, and refugee mothers and their children, were held in private prison camps. The Republicans promised to extend Obama's reactionary agenda without the smiling blackface mask. they assured greater tax handouts to Wall Street with none of the embarrassing rhetorical flourishes and more wars without the sanctimonious humanitarian aspect. Against this expanding panorama of social deterioration and war weariness, Bernie appeared. Bernie Sanders was to reincarnate the forthcoming of the progressive Democratic primary campaigner, messiah, and scupper any real movement to the left. Bernie Sanders, after the black con artist, bring out the Jewish house radical. By 2015, U.S. society was deeply polarized. After 7 years of Wall Street pillage under Democratic President Obama, the mass of working people were looking for an alternative. On the horizon, there was only more of the same promised from the rabid right, which ran the Republican Party. Massive voter abstention had propelled the Republicans to power in both houses in the elections of 2010, 2012, and 2014. Terror-mongering, the so-called global war on terror, no longer cut any ice with a population terrified of losing their miserable jobs or getting bankrupted by an illness in the family. The Pentagon resorted to paying unemployed actors to stage spontaneous displays of patriotism at huge sporting events, dressing up as veterans and running out on the fields with huge flags. There's been a big drop in healthy young Americans willing to sign up and fight in overseas wars, despite the continued prospect of being mired in poverty wage jobs in the so-called recovered domestic economy. The article goes on, but I'll go to the conclusion since we're getting close to time. The whole history of Democratic Party progressives is one of deceit, hypocrisy, and betrayal of millions of workers, minorities, and other oppressed and excluded groups. They rant and rave till the votes are counted, and then they dissolve their electoral organization and push their supporters into the party electoral campaign. They do not continue the struggle outside of the corrupt party. They simply go belly up, graciously conceding defeat and wagging their tails, hoping for a reward, like some inconsequential, toothless position within the administration if the Democrats win. After every one of the radicals' defeats, their supporters are left adrift. Indeed, they are worse off than before because their movements had been diverted into the Democratic primaries and away from the communities. The historical record is clear. After Jesse Jackson lost, the Rainbow Coalition fell apart. Civil rights movements were weakened. Police violence against blacks continued and even worsened. After Kucinich ran and lost, his grassroots supporters within the trade unions had no mechanism to block the relocation of auto, steel, and textile plants overseas. After Obama conned progressive Americans, the peace and justice movement virtually disappeared. The church, trade union, and neighborhood alliances accelerated Barack Obama's historic victory, have in reality experienced historical retreats. The only things historic about Obama's terms in office have been the $1 trillion bailout of Wall Street, the number of simultaneous wars waged by the Pentagon, the millions of people of color slaughtered in Libya, Syria, and Yemen, the thousands of minorities killed in cities big and small of the USA, and the tens of thousands lost to premature deaths in economically devastated rural and small-town America. The current Bernie Sanders roadshow is just recycling the past, right down to the same rhetorical and inconsequential promises of his predecessors. Some of his gullible followers claim that he is important for raising issues, when in fact he will just raise them and then demoralize their advocates. Other pundits claim he is challenging the Democratic Party from the left, when in fact he is doing everything possible to prevent millions of disaffected ex-Democratic voters, mostly workers and minorities, from rejecting the Democrats and joining for or forming alternative political movements. The key to understanding why millions of Americans fed up with 30 years of declining living and health standards, deepening inequalities, and perpetual wars do not form an alternative party is that they have been repeatedly conned and corralled in the Democratic Party by the House radicals. Jackson, Kucinich, Obama, and Sanders promised radical changes in the primaries and then have gone on to hand their supporters, mostly disaffected workers, over to the party oligarchs, abandoning them without their past social movements or future hope. Like castoffs, is there any wonder why so many abstain? Thanks for listening. We'll join each other again tomorrow. Take care.